this job gives us the privilege to think about a question that we really want to investigate and to answer things that haven't been answered before.
Today on Vox Talks Economics, from the CEPR Paris School of Economics Policy Forum 2026, three exciting pieces of new research from New Economists. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. I'm Tim Phillips. Every time I get away from my desk to visit a conference, I like to find the most interesting new research from economists who are just starting out in their careers. Here at PSE, a select few get 10 minutes to present their research to a live audience, and we pick three of them to present it to you too. So welcome to Costanza Tomaselli of Imperial College London.
Hi, Tim.
Moushek Tomasian of University Paris-Saclay.
Hi, Tim.
And Guido Lamamora of the University of Nottingham.
Hi, Tim.
Okay, guys. First of all, Guido, in your research, we're talking about agriculture, low-income countries. Now, they have a large share of workers in agriculture, but low farm productivity. So what's the usual explanation about why there are still so many people working in agriculture?
So Tim, this is actually a well-known pattern in developing economics called the food problem. The standard explanations usually combines two forces. On the demand side, because households are poor, they spend most of their income on food, which is a basic necessity. So domestic demand for agricultural goods is high. But on the supply side, low agricultural productivity means that you need many workers just to produce enough food to feed all the population. So the conventional story is that low agricultural productivity plus food subsistence needs means a lot of workers stuck in low productivity farming.
This is something that economists, policymakers are well aware of. What do they usually recommend to fix it?
There are two main prescriptions. First, these countries should try to raise agricultural productivity. So if more can be produced with fewer people, workers can move into industry and services where workers seem to be more productive. Mm-hmm. And second, these countries can open to trade. And so if these poor countries can import cheap food from abroad, they don't need as many workers to produce it. So labor can move out of the sector as well. So both policies are expected to shrink the agricultural employment share. So labor can move into these more productive sectors and start a process of development.
Now, this all seems to make perfect sense as far as it goes.
Exactly.
You've changed the way that this is modeled, though. What did you do?
What I did in my paper is to introduce two critical ingredients that are missing to explain this food problem in an open economy context. The first one is trade. Most of the literature treats countries as closed economies. So what you produce is determined by what you consume. But of course, countries do trade. So what a country produces is shaped by what it's relatively good at, not just by domestic demand. The second missing ingredient is land, because agriculture doesn't just use labor. It also uses land, which we can consider it as fixed. So ignoring this land or the land endowments can lead to a very distorted picture of who is actually productive. So a country may look like it has a low farm productivity per worker, but that could be simply because it has a lot of workers relatively to how much land it has. And it's not because their farming technology is bad in itself.
You're right. So you're putting land into the model here. What's that telling us about productivity?
What I found is like this will flip the conventional diagnosis. Because once you account for land, these low-income countries actually turn out to have a relative high agricultural productivity, not low. Hmm. And the reason that labor productivity looks low for these low-income countries is simply because there are many workers sharing a limited amount of land, which is driving down the output per worker mechanically. So these poor countries are not necessarily bad at farming.
Yeah, now that's the first time that I've ever heard that. As you say, I've heard hundreds of times the opposite.
Yes.
What does this tell us about the consequences of the standard policy prescription? Because the trouble is, you can't make land.
Exactly. And I think here is where my findings are more striking and policy relevant, because this standard intuition says, okay, raise agricultural productivity or open to trade, and workers are going to leave the farming and they are going to move into this, what it seems to be, more productive sectors. But my research shows the opposite when we accept the fact that countries do trade internationally. Let me just start with productivity. When these countries become more efficient at farming, they're going to become more competitive in world markets. So their exports of agricultural goods will rise, the production will expand, and the sector will actually demand more workers. In terms of opening to trade, the story has two competing forces. On one side, yes, there is this cheaper import that means that households can buy food from abroad and then reduce the domestic production and free up some workers. But on the other side, for these countries, having a better market access to foreign demand will allow countries to expand also their exports, pulling more labor into the sectors. And my results show that this export channel dominates. So trade openness tends to deepen the agricultural specialization in these low-income countries rather than reduce it, contrary to this standard prescription.
So I'm a policymaker. I've been following the World Bank's advice. You've got some time with me. What would you be recommending I did?
Well, my results points quite clearly toward industry. And in terms of these two mechanisms that I already mentioned, one is try to raise productivity, but the industrial productivity, which is going to generate larger gains than raising agricultural productivity, roughly twice as large in my estimates. And the reason is that industry is deeply connected to the rest of the economy through supply chains and input-output linkages. So when the industrial productivity rises, it will lower the cost economy-wide and it will benefit everyone. Another mechanism is reducing the cost of importing industrial goods, particularly for those that are going to be used in the agricultural sectors, and that will yield substantial gains through the same linkages. My results suggest some caution about treating agricultural productivity growth and agricultural trade liberalization as the primary route to reduce the employment in agriculture. Agriculture may well remain large in these economies, and that's not necessarily a problem. What my results point to instead is that investing in industrial capacity or reducing barriers to industrial imports, particularly for those that are going to feed the agricultural production, tend to generate much larger gains for the low-income countries.
Thank you. Costanza, you've got policy experience. What do you think?
This is very interesting. I think food policy nowadays is very debated, and of course the geopolitical shocks might impact food policy. So I was quite interested to understand why you study about demand elasticity and then how that impacts your work.
So demand elasticities are important because they kind of discipline this standard explanation of the food problem. The idea is that agriculture remains large in poor countries because food is a basic necessity and because it is difficult to substitute these agricultural goods with other goods. So I estimate how demand responds to income and prices, but in the an open economy settings. And the results show that this part of this conventional story is still valid. So agriculture behaves as a subsistence good, and the goods from different sectors are difficult to substitute. Even if demand behaves as in the standard way, trade can still reinforce the agricultural specialization.
How do you think about intermediate inputs and this input-output linkages that you have in your modeling?
Intermediate input matter for mainly two reasons. I would say measurement and transmission. So first, for measurement, at sector competitiveness does not depend only on its own productivity, but it also depends on the cost of the inputs, such as in the case of agriculture, fertilizers, machinery, transport, energy, etc. So if I ignore these input-output linkages, I may wrongly attribute the cost of cheap or expensive inputs to the agricultural productivity itself. So second, for transmission, and that is more important for the policy perspective, given that industry is deeply connected to the rest of the economy through these production networks, so when the industrial productivity improves or the industrial imports becomes cheaper, production costs will fall across many sectors and including agriculture, and that's why the industrial productivity and cheaper imported intermediate inputs generates larger gains than increasing productivity in agriculture alone.
Always nice to have something that's counterintuitive. Costanza, your research is about the rise in price of a critical input. Now, which critical input is this? What did you want to discover about it?
I think, like a lot of other people recently, every time I open the newspapers or I turn on the TV, energy is always at the forefront of any type of news article we see.
Yes.
And so I was really interested in, why is it the case? Why are energy prices becoming so volatile? And especially, why are energy shocks becoming so frequent? And particularly, we've seen that with the rise of geopolitical shocks, climate shocks, and supply chain fragmentation, a lot of energy crises have become very frequent. And this basically is becoming a priority for a lot of government. We've seen that the presidency of the G20, that was the US, put energy security at the top of their three priorities for the current presidency. So we've seen the energy security in the past, I would say, 5 years, has really become a top priority for many governments. Government always think, oh, there is an energy shock, how would this impact unemployment? However, unfortunately, a lot of the time, energy shocks come, they come with recession and with an increase in inflation. So it's a bit difficult to really detangle whether it's energy that caused something in unemployment or everything that comes with energy. So I really wanted to understand what was the impact of an energy shock on the labor market itself.
You're measuring the impact of an energy shock in one country. When you have a shock, generally speaking, it affects the price of energy in the same way everywhere. So what did you do to find some causal evidence here?
My context, to be specific, is Mexico. In Mexico, the electricity is produced by one company, which is a state-owned utility. And the company mainly uses natural gas for producing electricity, which it could be shocking because we all think about Mexico as a sunny country. So we thought maybe there's a lot of renewables, but that's not the case. And also what is maybe counterintuitive is that Mexico is not abundant in natural gas. They tend to import a lot of it from the States. Just the setting of Mexico is really show that a country that is really dependent on another country in terms of energy. So there's really no energy security there. What has happened is there was a climate shock in Texas, which has highly damaged the natural gas pipeline between the US and Mexico. So this has caused exogenous and unexpected increase in electricity price in Mexico. But what you were saying is correct. Usually we think there is an energy price shock and everyone is affected the same. But in this case, the type of fuel used to produce electricity is quite important. So those municipality or the firms in the municipality closer to a power plant that use mostly gas will be more affected than those in areas where maybe there is like hydropower or oil. So for this reason, I can use some spatial variation to see, okay, if you're closer to the gas pipeline, you might be more affected by this price shock. But if you're farther from it, you still will have an increase in prices, but it will be less. And I will use this in my reduced form results.
Okay, and you're matching this to some outcomes. What data are you using? What outcomes are you looking for?
When you go through the data part of your presentation is always very quick, but actually this was a lot of work for me. I have very good administrative data from the Central Bank of Mexico, and this took me 2 years to collate. Also, I had to be very entrepreneurial and contact people on LinkedIn to find this data. So I have, as I said, after these 2 years of groveling, I have this credit registry in Mexico. So any type of financial product a Mexican firm will have, I have access to the data on it, and I can match it with employer-employee data. So I basically can follow employee, I know their salaries, I know if they become unemployed and so forth. And then I also have access to balance sheet data of the firms. And then I did a freedom of information request to this provider of electricity in Mexico. So I have very detailed hourly information on generation price and demand. And finally, also, I wanted to understand not just what happens, but also how that happens. So I also was able to do a survey that was fielded by the central bank itself. And I think that was quite cool in a way, because then the sample of my survey is representative of the sample of my administrative data, so it can really be matched.
And so after all this groveling and freedom of information requests, when power prices did spike, how did different types of firms respond to this?
In my sample, firm will expand employment. And I see that this is due to two margins. So at the extensive margin, this is not absolutely a story of labor creation, but it will be a story of labor reallocation. Smaller informal firms will leave the market, so they will file for bankruptcy, and their employment will be reabsorbed by these larger surviving firms. While at the intensive margin, surviving firms shift the way they produce. So they will move their production to off-peak hours when energy is cheaper. This could explain why we see a rise in employment, because they will need someone to work night shift or weekends. And also they will sell their energy intensive machinery. So they will become less capital intensive and more labor intensive.
Again, this isn't the normal advice, is it? The standard advice is to use credit to smooth a shock.
I think a good thing in my paper that I do, which I think is one of the greatest contributions of the paper, actually, is to understand in a lot of cases we've seen in Europe and in the US, once there is an energy shock, government comes in, intervene. And so what we see in terms of firm response often is muted by this sort of government support. What was good about this shock is that, I mean, good for me, bad for the firms, is that the government didn't help the firms. So I wanted to understand, in absence of a government support, what could the financial market do? Can they help the firms? And what I noticed is that the firms that have access to credit compared to the ones that don't, they won't change their production at all. So they won't change their employment. And this is novel in the literature, because usually the literature either focuses on production things, so what happens to revenue, to capital, or to financial things. So what I can really do in this paper is to link the two and see whether there is a causal effect of having access to credit on the way you reshape your production after such shocks.
Now, what does it tell us about the role of credit? Because, well, many firms in many countries are thinking now about energy security.
That's a very important question. I think what that tells us is that government support is not the only answer. And also what we've seen in a lot of countries is that government tend to give this blanket support to all the firms in terms of energy subsidies, which of course are effective, but they also increase the public debt. This comes from the modeling side, so we should be a bit cautious about taking this as a this is better versus this is worse. But the suggestive evidence from the model is that if government, instead of having this blanket policy subsidies, also intervene in making credit friction lower, actually that would have a similar effect of a subsidy, but that would also lead to lower impact on the fiscal debt. So that would be quite important. Of course, I have to phrase this with caution, because banks are very good in understanding whether firms are good with credit and can repay. Governments sometimes lack this expertise. Making sure that credit is more available to everyone is better than government just giving out financial products to firms that don't have them.
Very interesting. Vishek?
It seems that these energy shocks are becoming more and more frequent, and so energy markets are becoming more volatile. Why do you think this work is timely, and what would be the policy recommendation that you would offer?
The backdrop is shifting very fast. I talk mostly about energy shocks and security, but on the flip side, we also know that energy demand is increasing a lot. We know that there is an increase in electrification. And I mean, every day we hear about AI and data centers needing a lot of more energy. So the countries that are not going to have the energy security that they need are actually going to fall behind in productivity potentially. So that's why this becomes quite important. And also at the same time, we live in a really peculiar period where we had a massive increase in geopolitical shock. We already had an increase in climate shock, and this make energy just like very volatile. So the combination of the two really put energy on the forefront of government priorities, and it's something that government should actually address.
Constanza, I found really interesting this idea that credit access appears to be one of the main mechanisms driving the firm responses to the energy shocks. So why do you think is that such an important insight?
This is one of the main contributions of the paper, is really trying to put together the production part of the firm with the financial side of the firm. Usually as economists, we think about input as, you know, there's elasticity between input and there will be an elasticity between how I substitute or I complement labor for energy. But what I show here is that if you have access to finance, you might not want to change your labor for energy at all. You might just want to smooth the shock. Having this access to credit or not having it really will translate in how an energy shock actually affects the whole economy. Access to credit or financial friction we really impact the way an energy shock is translated through the whole economy.
Again, it's very interesting and quite surprising as well. Now, Mushek, for your research, we go to Armenia.
Yes,
now,
we do.
Many people, including me, will not know very much about Armenia's economy. What sort of economy does Armenia have and who are its trading partners?
Well, think about a textbook small open economy that's a price taker in the global markets and a landlocked country that is still heavily dependent on trade with around 100% of its GDP being imports and exports. It's a transition economy. It used to be part of the Soviet Union and heavily dependent, as I've mentioned, on trade both with Russia and European Union. Before sanctions in 2021, around 30% of Armenian exports and imports were coming from and going to Russia, and around 15 to 20% were with the European Union. There's a lot of informality also in the country. So there's half of the population, sort of employment, labor force being in the informal sector. And like 20% of Armenian employment is going to be in the public sector. And there's mining and manufacturing and also agriculture. So a lot of sectors that are tradables.
Move 1 year forward from 2021 and Russia is sanctioned. How does Armenia's trade change when Russia is sanctioned?
Well, it had a booming effect on Armenian trade in both extensive margin and intensive margin. So trade-wise, everything just went up. The number of firms that are engaged in trade, the number of firms engaged in trading sanctioned goods, new partners appeared, both for sourcing and for destination, which I think is one of the interesting parts. And also, and when it comes to the intensive margin, Armenian trade boomed. And by boom, I mean 2 to 3 times growth in Armenian exports and imports. But what is interesting is the heterogeneity of what happened. And the real heterogeneity is in the partners and in the types of product. The Armenian exports to the European Union and the US stayed sort of flat. And so it's also true when it comes to the extensive margin of Armenian firms that are conducting exports. You don't see much of those firms entering into the European markets, but still a lot of new firms are created for sourcing. And what's also interesting partner-wise is that Armenian firms found new sourcing partners. We didn't do so much trade with, say, United Arab Emirates, with Hong Kong, which is quite far away from Armenia. And Armenian firms actually thought of it as a good idea to conduct exporting and importing from Hong Kong and, say, United Arab Emirates when the shock hit. Another source of heterogeneity is the types of products that are being traded. So there would be a lot of, I guess for obvious reasons, there would be a lot of expansion in the sanctioned goods dimension, which would be because of not just rerouting, but also there would be some production capacity expansion for certain firms. So this is sort of the two heterogeneity dimensions that I exploit, the partners and the sanctioned and non-sanctioned.
So what are the possible explanations for what's going on here?
Well, there could be three explanations. One is this genuine new productive capabilities and the expansion in the production, which is not so likely given how intense and how fast everything happened, intensively and fastly. The second story could just be a price story, which is that now there's this huge demand, huge vacuum trade-wise, say in Russia, and you're just trading the same volume for higher prices. And the first story could be rerouting, which is that Armenia is sitting in a nice position being in a customs union with Russia prior to 2022, having trade agreement with the European Union, which means that the firms have already established certain links with their counterparts in the European Union. So this goods could be coming into Armenia with, say, certain value-added or no value-added moving to Russia. What is also interesting is that you have certain goods coming from Russia, goods that were not traded prior, say, even by the incumbent firms, and going to what I call other non-sanctioning economies. So you would expect them to go to actually say EU, but actually Armenian firms are finding new destinations in other non-sanctioning economies.
To do your investigation, again, you're going to need some quite detailed data about this. Where'd you get that?
Well, I was lucky enough to acquire Armenian microdata, customs data, and Armenian matched employer-employee data, which is quite rare to have for a developing country. And this was part of and is still part of a broader effort to make Armenia accessible to researchers and to drive evidence-based policy in Armenia. So we're trying to institutionalize this access to Armenian data. I was lucky enough to get access to it because the State Revenue Committee of Armenia is now engaged in cooperation with researchers not just in the Armenian diaspora, but also globally and internationally, people who are interested in studying developing economies. I use Armenian highly detailed customs data at the daily level, which gives you information about the firms that are trading, about the goods that are being traded, about the partners, the volume, the value, and so on. And also information at the annual level about the firms and their turnover, their employment, their payroll. And also I know their employees and I know how many hours their employees are working and how much their salary is. And I use this information to study the firm level, employee level effects of this big, big trade shock that hit Armenia.
It is an extraordinary level of detail. It's a great opportunity. So what's the data telling you? Is this a change in Armenia's economy or is it just a stop in and out of Russia?
Well, it's not just about rerouting. Incumbent Armenian firms, big firms, are the ones that are actually using this opportunity to conduct more trade more intensively with the pre-existing partners. But as I've mentioned, they are finding new sourcing partners. So they're sourcing new goods from new sourcing partners, which also implies that their basket of trade is switching. So they're moving towards more and more, say, sanctioned goods, which are sophisticated goods like electronics or machinery or things that you use in manufacturing. So oil equipment and gas equipment and stuff like that. What's interesting is that this isn't cost less for these firms because they appear to be sharing these rents with their workers without actually increasing their production capacity. And what I mean by that is that you don't see relative increase in their employment size. But the workers are actually working more hours. This is why they would have to share some of the rents with their workers. Also, you're going to be seeing a lot of new importing firms. They're only conducting importing and you do not see them exporting. Mm-hmm. And these importing firms are going to be the ones that are also finding new sourcing partners in countries that had previously no exporting opportunity to Armenia.
It's wonderful how this new data that we're seeing around trade can really give us insights that we just wouldn't have been able to get to before.
I was wondering if after these sanctions to Russia and this trade boom, what happened with the resources across sector? Like they will pull in resources from one sector to another or it's just an expanding in trading within existing firms?
You do not really see the structural transformation pattern. You do not really see this workers reallocating across firms because again, there's going to be the relative employment size of this big trading incumbent firms that are exploiting this opportunity is still going to be the same relative to the non-trading firms. So this is not just a windfall because there are things that these firms are doing. They're taking care of what we call fixed costs in trade. So they are potentially taking loans to acquire new goods. So they're taking care of that friction. They are engaged in complex international logistics. They're finding new partners. They're finding new products. They're finding new partners in the destination market. So these are all potentially long-lasting things that post-sanctions, it's too early to say, but post-sanctions could potentially imply long-lasting implications.
I was curious to know whether the trade boom would reallocate workers across firms or whether they just stick to their firms.
They stick to their firms mostly, but the entry margin of a new importing firms that are what I call them non-traditional importers because they appear out of nowhere and they stay with the same partner, with the same product for a continuous period of time, they do need some labor. For those firms, these employees that they are having are just appearing out of what I call nowhere because they were not in formal employment prior. So this could be either they're moving from the informal sector or this could be Russian relicants coming from Russia post-war, reallocating to Armenia, opening up their own business, keeping up with their previous partners, which were in countries that were not trading with Armenia prior. But yes, if there is any reallocation across firms that I would observe, it would be from this extensive margin of new firms entering into importing business in Armenia.
One final question to all of you. Recently, you've been studying. I imagine you've all been teaching assistants as well. A lot of students now, they've got artificial intelligence that can help them, or maybe it's not helping them. For students who are studying economics today, what do you think's the best application of AI, and what do you think's the worst, Guido?
I think, yeah, the best application for AI is using it as a discussion partner. So you can use it to challenge an argument, test whether a result is intuitive or not, ask for alternative explanations or discuss how to structure an essay or a research idea, in the sense that it doesn't give you a final answer, but it helps you to think more clearly. The worst use, I would say, is using it as a substitute for thinking. Like if the student just copy and paste or just use AI to fill the blank page of a question, without understanding the materials, they will learn really little and they will also reproduce mistakes because AI can sound quite confident even when it is wrong.
Costanza.
For this paper I just discussed, I can't use AI for coding. And that's a bigger discussion, right? The Central Bank of Mexico doesn't allow AI usage for their remote servers and their data. But I would say another project that I have, I find it very useful for coding, to solve coding issues or to clean big data set. I think AI can be quite useful and can really speed the work of researcher. I have to agree with Guido where it's negative. One of the reasons I wanted to do a PhD is because this job gives us the privilege to think about a question that we really want to investigate and to answer things that haven't been answered before. And I'm not sure still to this day, maybe this will change in a couple of years, that creativity can be substituted with the use of AI. But unfortunately, what we've seen a lot growing in the past year are our students asking AI also to substitute the creative part of our process, which I think really would devalue our profession.
Yes, I completely agree with Guido and Constanza, because I do think that AI is a great teacher. So it's a nice professor for you to understand things that are hard for you to digest some ideas. It's a great explainer. It also takes care of routine things like coding or routine tasks that you would have hard time solving or you would need to spend a lot of time solving. The danger is that it could give you wrong answers, but that you wouldn't know about them. So it would give you plausible answers that you cannot evaluate because you skipped the work because you used AI. So I think that's the danger, and in that I completely agree with both Guido and Constanza.
I would like to say good luck today, because none of you have presented yet or done your poster session, so I hope that goes really well for you. Thank you very much, Guido.
Thank you, Tim.
Constanza.
Thank you.
And Mushek.
Thank you.
Those three papers are called The Food Problem in an Open Economy. Author Guido Lamamora. Energy Shocks, Employment Response and Heterogeneous Credit Access. Authors Costanza Tomaselli and Armando Rangel Colina. Trade and Firm Level Adjustments to Geopolitical Shifts. Evidence from Armenia. The author Mushek Tovmasyan.
Vox Talks Economics is a Torg Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian. This has been our final episode from the PSE CEPR Forum 2026. Vox Talks will be back in Paris in December for the CEPR Symposium, and we will return to the Paris School of Economics in 2027. But next week on Vox Talks Economics, living in a ghost town.